The Joan Marsden Lecture is named in honor of a former professor of zoology whose association with McGill has spanned 60 years, starting from her undergraduate degree in the 1940s and moving on to 2001. When she came back from earning her doctorate at Berkeley, Joan Marsden was hired as a lecturer to teach comparative anatomy to pre-med students. And then she moved up and started doing her own research on marine invertebrates in the Bellairs Research Institute in Barbados, and she became ultimately the chair of the zoology department. And it was through her leadership, in large part, that there was a grand merger of departments of zoology, botany, and genetics that formed the biology department of McGill in 1970. She retired in 1987, but she remained as director of the Bellairs Research Institute until her death in 2001. She was so well liked by her colleagues that they decided to set up a fund to perpetuate her memory through the Joan Marsden Memorial Lectures in Organismal Biology. This fall's Marsden lecture is Dr. Dan Simberloff from the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. Dan earned his doctorate at Harvard in 1969 under the supervision of E.O. Wilson, and his doctoral research provided the first experimental test of MacArthur and Wilson's theory of island biogeography. And he was hired through Florida State University at Tallahassee, where he remained for about two decades or more, prior to taking on his current position, an endowed chair, the Nancy Gore Hunger Chair in Environmental Science at Knoxville. Dan's contributions are too numerous to name, so I won't attempt to, but they have been recognized in numerous awards, most notably in 2006 by the Ecological Society of America, the Eminent Ecologist Award, which was previously given to people of the stature of Elton, Hutchinson, MacArthur, Wilson, Eugene Odom, and Robert Payne, and among others. He also, in 2012, he was elected to the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, and in the same year, he was awarded the Ramon Margalev Prize. And earlier this year, he won the Alfred Russel Wallace Prize, given by the International Biogeographical Society. He has been involved in some of the most vigorous, sometimes rancorous debates in the history of the field. The field went through a lot of growing pains, some of which inflicted by him. They include, for example, the application of island biogeography to the design of nature reserves, the use of null hypotheses in community ecology, the value of wildlife corridors, the risks of biological control, more recently, the role of non-native species in conservation. He has a reputation for challenging bandwagons, and I suspect we're going to see another example of that tonight. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Dan Simberloff.
Thank you, Tony. This is actually the third time I've spoken in the biology department here at McGill. I'm on a 17-year cycle. I spoke in 1981. Which was a fearsome experience that I won't go into. Then 1998, and now 25. So I'll be here again in 2032. And I guess the reason it was a 17-year cycle, it takes 17 years for the faculty who were already there to have left, the students have left, so they don't remember how bad my previous talk was, and they forget, and they invite me back. But I'm very glad to be here. This is the coolest lecture room I've ever given up. Talking. The previous two were in the biology building and weren't nearly as redolent with history as this one. Yeah. So I'm going to talk about what I think has been a terrible turn in the development of conservation science and the whole conservation movement. You'll see what I'm driving at very soon and how it's really ended up devaluing biodiversity, which was the original conservation goal, as the goal of conservation. I'll begin by talking a little bit about the whole idea of environmental ethics, which is now a major field of philosophy, but actually it's a very new field. And this is the first paper in 1973 that said, hey, we need a field of environmental ethics and should consider the ethical and moral aspects of our activities with respect to the environment, including other species. And it struck a responsive chord in the field of philosophy. So pretty soon there was a whole journal, Environmental Ethics, and it really had two major developments that bear on conservation. The first one, philosophers use the term moral considerability to say that an entity has a status or a standing that we must take into account for ethical reasons. We can't just use it as an instrument and not think of its own intrinsic value or worth. And this led to the whole sort of animal welfare and animal rights movement heavily influenced it. And more germane to my talk today is it led to a large philosophical literature on biodiversity and species and the our ethical obligations to individual species, and should we be concerned about causing the extinction of entire species. And these are two of the sort of landmark books in that literature. But the point is that not just individuals, but even entire species have status, moral considerability. At about the same time, the whole idea of what we now call biodiversity sort of bursts on the scene. The first reference I can find to the term biological diversity in the sense we're talking about was this 1968 book by Raymond Dassman. Maybe someone here knows an earlier reference. But this didn't really catalyze interest in what we now think of as biodiversity, especially species richness as a focus. But in 1980, Tom Lovejoy's foreword to a widely read textbook at the time in conservation biology talked about biological diversity and and the importance of preserving biological diversity, basically for ethical reasons, that we cannot let species go extinct. And in 1988, in the proceedings of a conference organized at the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S., the term biodiversity became the title of the book. Ed Wilson was the editor of this book, and it was from that point on that the term biodiversity became really a watchword, or even the hallmark of conservation science and conservation biology. And at that time, the discussion was not really focused on what biodiversity does for humans. It was biodiversity and species for their own sake. There was discussion of what they do for us, but the ethical obligation not to let them go extinct was really the prime aspect of the literature at this time. And of course, a crowning moment then in the rise of biodiversity as a concept and as a focus of conservation was the Rio Summit Convention on Biological Diversity. But I feel that even at its founding, the seeds of its own perversion or destruction was established, because when you ask, and right at the beginning it said preserving biological diversity, but then the sustainable use of its components. And here it says very clearly that the convention recognizes that biological diversity is about more than plants, animals, and microorganisms and their ecosystems. It's about people and how we can use them. That wasn't, at that time, the real main focus of conservation biology and conservation science. But this was really a critical passage and a critical part of the convention that attracted ever more attention. And of course, you know, we all celebrated International Day for Biological Diversity. I hope we celebrated. I don't know what they did. And we even celebrated it in Knoxville, Tennessee. So we probably celebrate here. But you can see that by then, by 2015, the reason for biodiversity and the reason that we preserve it is for sustainable development, which is for human use. Now let me talk about ecosystem services. There had been discussion, some earlier discussion, of what ecosystems do for us in the 70s. But this was the paper that really caught the attention of a very large readership. It was published in Science, and it was about what ecosystems, as ecosystems, do for humans, and discussed how we value them. What are they worth? And it's interesting. Westman was a biologist at UCLA at that time, and even his epigraph, though, points to the problem of how we value them. And he said right at the outset, well, you know, how much was it worth? And how hard it is really to place a quantitative value on something like the existence of a flower. And I love this metaphor at the end. Quantitative estimates of the worth of nature to man are likely to remain asymptotic to the value expressed by the poet's phrase. Nevertheless, in this paper, he made an effort to quantify in dollar terms the value of various ecosystem services. Then we move to this very widely read book by the Ehrlichs on extinction, and especially on the consequences of extinction. And so this is a lot about what services nature provides to humans, but it's by species, not by ecosystems. And it has example after example of what species do, not only for one another, but in some way that contribute to human well-being. So it's the services of species, not ecosystems. This, and they noticed this, it was very clear. So it wasn't by itself a ringing defense of saving all species, because they gave example after example of particular species. And yet they wanted to make it a defense of preservation of all species. And so they had to ask the question, well, why does it matter for those species that they didn't use as examples that are providing very specific services for humankind? And this is, for this, they erected one of the famous metaphors in ecology. And ecology has many famous metaphors. This is one of the most famous, the rivet-popper hypothesis. And they said, look, species are, and ecosystems are like analogous to an airplane and the rivets holding its wings together. And they said, what we're doing now by causing species extinction is analogous to an insane rivet popper walking along the wing, removing this rivet. Well, the plane doesn't crash. Then the next rivet, plane doesn't crash. Then the next rivet, plane still doesn't crash. But, you know, at some point, maybe the 23rd rivet, suddenly the entire plane crashes. And their argument is that's really what we're doing when we cause extinction. So they didn't really give a specific mechanism for what the number of species does and the fact and a rationale other than this metaphor for why we need all the species. This metaphor, which we now see in many conservation books and ecology books, and this question about what do all the species contribute to human well-being, then ultimately later, and I'll talk about it in a moment, became really the foundation for a research program that dominated ecology for about 10 years. What is it that losing the rivet actually does, or why does the edifice crash when the 19th species goes extinct but not the 18th species? Gretchen Daly, who was Paul Ehrlich's student, in 1997 wrote this book all about nature services, but notice the difference. This is the services of ecosystems, not of species. And it's all about what ecosystems as a whole do for us, things like flood control, modifying weather, et cetera. But it's at the ecosystem level with a lot about the economic value of these various services, but always at the ecosystem level. Now, economics has a long history as of metaphoric use in both evolution and ecology. I'm sure that we've all read at some point The Origin of Species, and there's a very striking metaphor that Darwin used that crops up again and again. and that is The Economy of Nature. And it was a metaphor. He almost certainly borrowed it from a contemporary economist, but it was a metaphor. It's not like an economic valuation of nature, but about costs and benefits to different species of different adaptations. So it's a metaphoric use. And in ecology, there have been other, this is a whole paper in Science in 97 pointing to the use of economic models of that sort, metaphoric use of the term economics in ecology, which had been quite prominent in the 70s and even in the 60s. Again, about costs and benefits in terms, in this case, of energy or of benefits or debits to fitness, et cetera. So these are metaphoric uses of economics. But in the same year that Gretchen Daily wrote her book about ecosystem services, we have this famous paper. It's got to be one of the most widely cited papers in all of science, I guess, which isn't metaphoric at all. It's about the economic value of nature. Okay, in case you were worried, now you know. This is how much nature is worth to us, about $33 trillion a year. There's the answer. And this paper was so important that the same paper was published twice, exactly with not a word changed. I've tried to figure out how I can write a paper that I can do that with, but I've never succeeded. So this is a very different sort of use of economics in ecology. It's not a metaphoric use, but an attempt actually to put monetary valuation on nature. So it was a small and inevitable step, I feel. Once we put an economic value on something, it's inevitable that one will seek to create a market in it or in parts of it and to profit from it. And so we have Dewey and Ellison's book in 2002 using Darwin's metaphor, the economy of nature, but not as a metaphor, as actual the economics in dollar terms of nature. And the idea is not only to put the value, but to make it profitable to conserve nature. I'll talk a little. What we mean by nature in this case was left undefined in this book and also in the Costanza et al. Paper, and I will talk a little bit about that. But this is the beginning of the effort somehow to put a market, to create a market in nature, but in particular in ecosystem services as the expression of nature. And around this time, people began to talk about not nature, but natural capital. And at Stanford now, there's an entire program in which I'm sure many of you have read about and maybe even participated in, about natural capital, nature as capital. And it's about real capital. It's about economic valuation of capital. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment is really sort of the apotheosis of the replacement of biodiversity as the raison d'etre of conservation science, but rather of ecosystem services. Millennium Ecosystem Assessment defines ecosystem services, the benefits people derive from ecosystems. Of course, once we talk about services, well, it has to be services for some one or thing, and the services are for humans. So that's the definition. And why we care about, there's nothing in this whatsoever about intrinsic value of species or biodiversity per se, but this is why biodiversity loss is a concern. It's nothing to do with the species themselves. It's because biodiversity is central for ecosystem service and hence for human well-being. Well-being, I won't get to talk about much, but a lot of the literature then about ecosystem services talks about it in terms of providing human well-being without much discussion of how we define it and what we mean by well-being for humans. But in any event, my point here is that biodiversity loss is a concern not because of biodiversity in its own right, but because of its instrumental value to humans. And the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment really sort of defined the way we talk about ecosystem services and created a vocabulary for dealing with this. This is the document, the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, that defined the four kinds of services that we talk about. It's a little different from economists, who distinguish between goods on the one hand and services on the other. Millennium Ecosystem Assessment makes what we would have called goods, or economists would have, into a kind of service, provisioning services, so like timber or food. But notice that here's where biodiversity comes in. It's life on Earth, and it supports these services, which in turn, in various combinations, affect components of human well-being. It's not directly that biodiversity affects human well-being, and it doesn't really have value in its own right. That's not why we should be worried about it, according to the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. Another important thing that was certainly already recognized in the literature, but was codified by the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, was that ecosystem processes, rather than components, species, are really the key to most of the services that we are concerned with. And biodiversity directly generates some services, like the provisioning services, because it is species that are provided or that are provisioned for us. But biodiversity affects ecosystem function, right? And ecosystem function, through various processes, provides all these other services that are the main ones that are said to contribute to human well-being. So it's this nexus, biodiversity, ecosystem function, ecosystem services, that led to the dominance of the research program in North America and in Europe and in elsewhere, to try to show that biodiversity per se affects ecosystem function, and that increased biodiversity was increased ecosystem function. Now, of course, one could have a whole course on the outcome of 10 or 15, it's now about 10 years where this research program dominated, but there are two different views about it. I guess many people in this room, this is sort of the Canadian view, I guess, Srivastava and Vellens, and so you should be favorable to it. Is it relevant to conservation? And they say, no, it's not really relevant to conservation, except in very limited circumstances. Their main argument for saying this is it only focuses on very few services, usually just productivity, period. And secondly, the scale is too small. The experiments and the observational work are on things like the difference between ecosystem function in terms of production, for example, between one species and two, or between one species and four, etc. But it doesn't really relate to, does it matter in an ecosystem of 214 species, is that different in terms of ecosystem function from one of 209 species? It's not really relevant at the scale that conservation is concerned. Well, here's another annual review by Dave Tillman, one of the leaders of the research program, says, no, that's all wrong, and the research program has shown that biodiversity is crucial to ecosystem functioning. And I guess you can have your own views. My own feeling is that, of course, if you have a lot of really smart people putting a lot of energy into studying the relationship of biodiversity and ecosystem functioning, of course, you'll learn quite a bit. But I think it hasn't really shown what Tillman and I'll say. I think the main take-home message from many of these projects is the particular importance of particular species to ecosystem function, like nitrogen fixers among plants, for example. And the scale problem that Srivastava and Vellens discussed pervades the entire literature, in addition, about, you know, whether it really matters at the number of species and ecosystems that we're really concerned with. But again, this would be at least a lecture on an entire course. it was then inevitable that conservation science should be transmogrified to reflect this new emphasis on services rather than on species and biodiversity. And this is, I guess, the manifesto that tries to do this by Peter Kreeve and Michel Marvier, although they had been writing papers for several years before that, doing this, but without actually defining a new conservation science. But it's you know, a whole new set of principles, and you can see where it's coming from. You know, it's the corporate sector, working landscapes. I always like the term working landscape as a metaphor. Working landscapes, the landscapes that humans are exploiting in one way or another. So if you happen to see a forest that humans aren't exploiting, I guess it's sitting around. You know, it's not it's not working. And it's all about ecosystem services. And it also argues that what we should be doing is simultaneously maximize the preservation of biodiversity and ecosystem services, because they automatically improve human well-being, not really defined in this paper. So the idea of simultaneous maximization of these two different things is a constant in the new conservation science. And of course, we all know that it's not automatically true that we can simultaneously maximize different things. It might be, but that's an empirical question. And so here's the textbook that follows it, conservation science. So it's balancing the needs of people first and nature. And look at what nature is here. This is nature. And it becomes clear in this literature and literature I'll talk about in a moment that nature is really that there are species there. That's nature. And as long as there are species there, nature is there. So we could say nature is resilient if there are species. So a parking lot has nature. There may be grasses growing in interstices between the cement. That's nature. But, you know, the people are the main needs of people, and nature is not the sort of nature that conservation science has been focused on until this time. As I said, that manifesto was not the first sort of move in this attempt to redefine conservation science. They had a widely cited paper, Biodiversity Cold Spots. As you know, beginning with Norman Meyer's several publications, much of conservation has been focused on biodiversity hotspots, places on Earth that have a very large number of species and should be then the target by the old conservation science of conservation efforts. But this paper says, no, that's wrong, because they don't provide ecosystem services automatically. And there are many cold spots, which are places that don't have too many species, but that provide lots of ecosystem services for humans, and we should be conserving those, leading to this debate, which even the New York Times picked up. So it's a very different conception of what conservation science should be doing and what its mission should be. Well, this inevitably led to a response, and probably the most thoroughgoing response is by Dan Doak et al. And Dan Doak was actually Peter Kreeve's graduate student. He's now a faculty member at Colorado. But they said, no, this is all wrong, and it's founded on a number of misconceptions, which I've added to a bit here. But these are sort of the central premises that Doak and or I feel are they're misstatements in the founding document of the new conservation science. Kreeve and Marvier argue that this emphasis on biodiversity has no regard for human welfare, therefore harms disadvantaged people and impedes business and development. Well, it does impede business and development to an extent. I'm not sure why that's bad, but it's not so clear that it really hurts disadvantaged peoples in many circumstances. And there's a difference between short-term, you know, economic loss on the one hand and real welfare. This gets to the issue of what we really mean by human well-being, which they don't explore. It says the old conservation rests on the myth of a pristine nature, strives to conserve and restore this state never existed. Well, you know, for 35 or 40 years, we've known that ecosystems are dynamic entities and communities are not static, even climax communities, and that they change constantly with comings and goings of some species and with differences in the relative proportions of many species. And restoration has not been looking to recreate this pristine nature, but rather to remove some obvious human influences that have affected this or dominated the trajectory of ecosystems. The new conservation people argue that it assumes nature is fragile when in fact it's resilient and recovers rapidly from, well, you know, that's not really what the literature says. If we define nature as whatever species are there, it's true that nature is resilient because there will always be species there no matter what we do. But, you know, a very large part of the literature of the last 30 years or so in both conservation biology and in ecology shows that nature is, particular ecosystems and communities can be set on very different courses and are not always resilient. So I think this rests on the definition of nature. And it says, old conservation fails, we still see extinction and ecosystem degradation. Well, we do, and we're all either pessimistic or at least despondent about this fact. But I think the proper null hypothesis, and I'm, as you know, an advocate of null hypotheses, would be, is it better than it would have been if we didn't have conservation biology? And would it be better with the new conservation science? And I'll talk about that in a moment. But I would argue it hasn't failed. It's certainly, you know, there are overwhelming forces against it, but there are a number of triumphs of old conservation biology. Finally, they're especially targeting the U.S., that it's failing socially, the population at large doesn't care about it. I would argue with that. Poll after poll shows that the population at large does care about it, and cares about it more than it used to. It's just that it cares about other things also, and so it hasn't utterly transformed the conversation about nature and the environment. In any event, you know, so the new conservation science, these first two are just quotes from Kariva and Marvier. So because of the five previous statements that they misstate, in my opinion, the ultimate goal of conservation is better management of nature for human benefit, period. That's the end of it. The second thing is we should try to maximize biodiversity, but without compromising development goals. And finally, and this is not a quote, but a paraphrase, you know, they argue over and over that we should be focusing much more on urban species, urban landscapes, and on species that are useful to humans in some very obvious way. Now let me turn to novel ecosystems, which are the new ecological world order. So what are novel ecosystems? This is sort of the manifesto about novel ecosystems, and Hobbes is the senior author and the author of many of the papers and the book. So in this paper, the argument is that we are inevitably and irrevocably changing ecosystems all around the world, and most of them are already greatly changed, the main two forces being introduced species on the one hand and the increasing impacts of global climate change on the other, and we can't do much about this. And so what do we have? We have novel ecosystems, and we can mold them to some extent or manage them to provide ecosystem services. So rather than grieving about the loss of what we had viewed as the targets of conservation, we should rejoice in the fact that we still have ecosystems and that they can even provide ecosystem services, and that this is the new ecological world order, a rather modest statement about what novel ecosystems are. So if you look closely at the novel ecosystems literature and new conservation science, the first four of those, what I would say is misstatements about conservation biology, actually are misstatements in much of the novel ecosystems literature. I've left off that it's not connecting with the population at large, but all of these other things that they argue, well, you know, we should be worried more about humans, not biodiversity. This idea is that pristine nature is a myth and we still believe in it when, in fact, we don't really, or we haven't for many years. The idea is that nature is really very resilient. That's why we have novel ecosystems. They are ecosystems. They have species. They're nature, but it's a very different nature. And that, anyway, we can't do much about it. Conservation has failed. These things happen. And so we have to use what we are left with, and those are novel ecosystems. Also known as the new normal, Emma Maris is the best-known sort of popular science writer to talk about this. And this is her book, Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature. This is nature that she's saving in a post-wild world. So again, this is the redefinition of nature as whatever species are there. And she uses the analogy of the five stages of grief. She says, look, these old conservationists are at the first stage of grief, which is grieving. And then they have to move through the next stage, which is anger, et cetera. And the fifth stage is then acceptance. So that if we're not getting with the new program of novel ecosystems, we're psychologically impaired by the fact that we're still grieving. I guess I would be in the second stage, anger, et cetera. And this was such a great metaphor that Cobbs took it without citation and used it in his paper in Restoration Ecology, the five stages of grieving process, et cetera. And those restoration ecologists that are benightedly still trying to restore some semblance of what they think is pristine nature are clearly early in the grieving process. They're probably in denial. And eventually, they'll grow up and reach acceptance. So it's novel ecosystems. And you know, inevitably, there was a response. And as Tony said, I've been involved in many spitting matches about different aspects of ecology. And I got involved in another one, a long critique, and then their response, and then our response to their response. But you know, the things that are wrong with it, there are several that we pointed out in our critique. One is that it's ill-defined. According to Hobbs et al., it's a physical system of abiotic and biotic components and interactions that by virtue of human influence differs from those that prevailed historically, having a tendency to self-organize and retain its novelty without future human involvement. But then he goes on to say, well, you know, all ecosystems are changing. We've known that. And so all ecosystems could be considered novel. And so how do you know when you have one or when you're dealing with a novel ecosystem? It's almost impossible. More recently, they've come up with an intermediate state called a hybrid ecosystem, which is intermediate between an old and doomed pristine ecosystem on the one hand and the new useful novel ecosystem on the other. But again, there's no definition of when we have one of these. So that's one really serious problem. The word is used without any, it's impossible to say anything about them without knowing what they really are. Are they inevitably really the new normal and ubiquitous? Well, of course, if a species is already extinct because of human activity, directly or indirectly introduced species or what have you, one could say it's now has to be a novel act. But again, without it being defined, since we know that even without extinction, ecosystems gain species and lose species over long enough time sequence, and sometimes rather quickly. I don't know. There are certainly large parts of North America, South America, not so much in the old world, that are pretty similar to, you know, systems that, you know, that existed a couple hundred years ago. I just don't know what to make of it, because we can't define it. Have they crossed irreversible thresholds? There's no direct evidence that that's true. Of course, if we take species extinction as one impact, we could say, well, of course, that's irreversible. But that doesn't, in their papers, doesn't seem to be the only thing they're talking about. The diagrams are sort of like this. You can see that all the diagrams in that literature don't have numbers on the axes. You know, they're labeled, but they're not quantified. But here you see that it's moving, this is the most recent one, from the historical one through the hybrid ecosystem to the novel ecosystem. And here are the thresholds. And we see that some of them are designated as irreversible. You can't go back once you... But it's hard to know what to make of it. I would have argued that many major changes probably could be reversed. It would take a tremendous expense and a lot of science, which we haven't often been willing to devote to that, but it's not clear that they're irreversible, or what it even means exactly to say irreversible with undefined borders to the whole concept. Are these various restoration activities really fruitless and a waste of resources, which is one of the main complaints of the novel ecosystem group, that, well, we're not doing well with restoration, et cetera. Well, we're not doing well with climate change yet. With introduced species, there's much progress. This is sort of the pessimistic statement about how we can't do anything about it. It appeared in a news report in Science by Mark Gardner, who was then the director of the Darwin Research Station. Time to embrace the aliens, blackberries. Here he's talking about this species. More than 30,000 hectares. They are terrible. They decrease native biodiversity, but we can't get rid of it, and so we should call it an honorary native and accept it. But you know, there's, again, this would be an entire course. Maybe Tony gives this course here. I don't know. But there are many successes as well as failures in controlling and sometimes eradicating introduced species, and with various techniques of controlling them short of eradication, increasing successes in eradication, and whole new approaches to trying to deal with it. This is a table from a special issue of Biological Invasions, all about using genetics, primarily versions of transgenes and meiotic drive, to get rid of invasive fishes in different approaches. At least three of these, four of them, are being developed, and one they've attempted to implement. And some of you have read about the Oxitec mosquito that actually did eradicate an entire species from an island. So it's a new world. This is a very recent paper saying, hey, we can use CRISPRs for gene drives, and one of the things we can do is get rid of introduced species. I don't know if they're right, but there are a number of people using gene drives of one sort or another. There's ongoing projects to deal with not only dipterans, but lepidopterans, mammals, rodents in particular, and at least one with plants also. So there's quite a bit of research in this area, and I think there's reason to think we can have more successes. Do novel ecosystems self-organize and retain their characteristics? I don't know where that comes from, but the ecosystems from which we draw what are called provisioning services now certainly do not self-organize, and they don't retain their characteristics without lots of input from us in terms of fertilizer, watering, sometimes weeding, et cetera, et cetera. So this seems to be an aspiration or a belief that this is the case, but there's not really evidence for it. And then there's the argument, well, traditional restoration has lost its constituency. Well, Hobbes and his co-authors are restoration ecologists, and they believe that it's futile to do what they've been doing. But lots of other restoration ecologists don't feel that way, and many international and national programs refer very specifically to implementing traditional restoration activities and are doing it. So it's, you know, if the constituency is being lost, it's certainly being helped in being lost by the novel ecosystem idea. Finally, there are potential downsides to the hype about novel ecosystems. And the first and most obvious one is that by conferring an air of inevitability to the entire idea of the degradation and change of ecosystems, it inspires pessimism and suggests we shouldn't continue with trying to do even what we're doing. Secondly, it's sort of a get out of jail free card for people that want to trash the landscape for one reason or another, and it's actually been used in this way. We can cite at least three instances now of large landholding firms saying, "Hey, we're producing novel ecosystems that can be used, et cetera, et cetera." So it's not just idle conversation. It has a potential serious downside. This will be a slight but highly relevant diversion about how this whole new conservation science, ecosystem services, and novel ecosystems has completely changed the direction of the Nature Conservancy. I was on the Board of Governors of Nature Conservancy for 11 years, and I've been a member for many, many years. Many of you weren't even born when I became a member of Nature Conservancy. And Nature Conservancy has actually had an enormous beneficial impact on conservation, not only in the U.S. but worldwide. This is the U.S. Nature Conservancy. Its president and CEO now is Mark Turchik, who comes from Goldman and Sachs. He's basically an investment banker. So this is his book. It's basically a development of Daly's idea that we can profit from nature conservation and of the Kareeva and Marvi idea that we can simultaneously somehow maximize real conservation with ecosystem services for monetary benefit. And it's really totally changed the direction of the Conservancy. For all these years, at least 15 years, this was the motto that captured the mission of the Conservancy. We're saving the last great places. And the Conservancy's main activity was to find great places in terms of which species were there, and especially threatened species, and save them, buy them, and then try to arrange for their subsequent purchase by a governmental agency or some other NGO that would in perpetuity maintain them. So we're saving the last great places. And then suddenly, in 2012, we see a different mission statement, protecting nature for people today and future generations. Here's nature. This is a great place, I guess. Protecting nature for people today and future generations. And what's really happened, if you look at the day-to-day activities of many of the staff, it's been transformed from saving the great places to helping industry to make the least environmentally damaging bad choices when they trash the landscape. Project after project of listing the possible ways we could modify the landscape or where they could drill, if that's what they want to do, and what impact that might have, and hoping that they'll use that to pick the one that's least damaging. There's nothing whatsoever, which I think people should do if they're going to, but I don't think it's what the Conservancy, which is that's what it used to. I don't think that's saving the last great places on Earth. Kareeva is the chief scientist of the Nature Conservancy. Here's what he says in the Conservancy Science Chronicles, which is targeted at the Conservancy staff. Infested and novel ecosystems we valued are not shunned as somehow unworthy. large expanse of ecosystems infested with invasive species, some of which might seem like pretty, that support a lot of animal species, including threatened and endangered species. So, you know, this should really be a target of what the Conservancy does. He gives this talk, Overcoming Dogma of Doom to Save Nature, and it's about all of the arguments about how the old conservation has failed, the myths of pristine nature, et cetera, the fragility of nature, says that conservation biologists are obstructionists to the new technology, by which he means they don't buy techno fixes that provide a service. One thing I didn't talk about is the focus on jobs versus nature. Both Turchik and Kariva feel that if we ever get in a situation, as often happens in the U.S., because of our Endangered Species Act, where you have some sort of development project stopped because it destroys the habitat of a listed species, that we've lost the battle and we should give up. So if spotted owls are keeping loggers from cutting an old-growth forest, or if delta smelt is keeping is diverting water from agriculture to preserve this small fish, or if some salmon run is endangered and so we put limits on it, we should give up because we're losing the public battle. It's not at all clear to me that that's the case. We've saved many species because of the Endangered Species Act, and it has withstood this kind of objection. But that's, so in any event, the Nature Conservancy has really shifted its focus tremendously, and it's now about human, you know, aiding industry and about benefit of ecosystem services for humans. Well, you know, I'm not the only one saying things like this, and so it's been recognized that a lot of people are unhappy with the new conservation science, novel ecosystems, and the focus on services. And so there's this op-ed attempting to be ecumenical by Emma Morris, who wrote the book that I showed, and Greg Applett is the chief scientist of the Wilderness Society, saying, hey, we didn't really mean that the new normal won't have any room for old conservation. It'll have a little room for it, and you can still save some sites, but the real program is helping to produce useful novel ecosystems. And it repeats a number of the misstatements, like, you know, the idea that we believe in a pristine, unchanged nature, et cetera, et cetera. And Hobbes and others have backed off a little bit to say, hey, in the New World Order, it's not that everything will be novel, and we might have a pathway not just to novel ecosystems, but back to historical ecosystems, depending on, you know, on this complicated pathway, et cetera, but that most of it will be novel. So they've recognized that there is an issue. Nevertheless, this is the theme of the Ecological Society of America meeting next year in Fort Lauderdale. So I'm hoping that none of you will go. Okay? As a longtime member and eminent ecologist of the Ecological Society, I think this is a travesty, and it's also in Fort Lauderdale, which is a terrible place in the summer. So there's no good reason to go to this meeting, but make a statement. And I'll close by talking a bit more about the monetization. I think there are really two aspects of the ecosystem services that have led us to this path. One is the transformation of the goal from biodiversity per se to ecosystem services, and the other is the inevitable then attempt to put monetary value on ecosystem services. A lovely paper that says it's a slippery slope. And it's a slippery slope in many ways. There are, of course, the idea then to profit from nature and make it profitable has led to these various payment for ecosystem service sorts of schemes. And the whole idea of them, and our hope as conservationists, is by paying for the ecosystem services, we will also be saving species. So, of course, RED, which is reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, is one of the most prominent ones. And there's little doubt that by keeping some forests from being cut down by virtue of paying their owners, we are saving habitat for some species that would otherwise probably be in bad shape. But there are well over 100 of these, and they've been examined in some detail, especially by the project called TEEB, the Economics of Ecosystems and Biodiversity, who've shown quite conclusively that, in general, these have not helped to save biodiversity. It's not even clear that they've usually provided more ecosystem services. In this case, a service sequestering carbon, really. So the contention that the old conservation science isn't working, and this will do better, at least in terms of its own terms of ecosystem services, and the terms I think should be the right ones, which is conserving biodiversity, is a fiction so far. There's no real evidence that the new conservation science is working for any of its goals. And there are, of course, many parts of nature, broadly defined, that the new conservation science won't really try to conserve. If they don't provide an ecosystem service for humans, there's no good reason to preserve them. If they don't contribute to some ecosystem's viability via either the rivet popper approach or some other reason why they're important to the ecosystem, there's no reason to preserve them. And of course, there are many processes that are critical to lots of species that are not something humans want, like periodic fires in many places, or floods, or what have you. We've spent, many ecosystems are in trouble because we suppress fire now. And it's also led to many invasions because humans want to suppress fire. So I think there's sort of two ways in which there's a Trojan horse aspect of this entire movement. The first is, once we define nature as whatever species provide services for us, it means that species become fungible. It doesn't matter if it's species A or B or C, as long as it provides a service. So it suggests that there's no ethical obligation, because we're not talking about ethics here. It's all about the monetary value of the service itself. And then the monetization makes it even worse, because if we can find some technical way or engineering way, like building levees and dams, to provide the service that, say, a wetlands would have in terms of flood control, then it gives license to, forget about the ecosystem and the species in it and simply provide the service. So I think we've been led by this Trojan horse to a very serious situation in which biodiversity is not being, we're not aiming conservation at preserving biodiversity anymore. And I'll stop there. And before I take questions, I'll engage in a tremendous cop-out. If the question is, what should we do about it, I can't answer it. I don't know. I've pointed to the problem, and I suspect there are ways to redress this and bring us back to focusing on species in their own right, but how to do it exactly, I don't know. So you could ask the question, but I'll say I can't answer it. So other than that, I'll be glad to take questions.
I'll let you field the question.
Okay. Hello?
Question?
There are no questions. Everyone agrees with me completely, obviously. Oh, there is a question from Andrew. Yep.
So I just, for the last week, was sitting in a conference that was organized by Colin Scott at McGill that was largely about the role of indigenous communities and interaction with conservation science. And it was an eye-opener for me, because there was a very different perspective about these old-school conservation biology, where you have fortress conservation, you keep people out, you protect the biodiversity. And it seems like many of the arguments that you say are very easy to take from the perspective of Western people going in and
taking out resources and things like that. But what about indigenous peoples that have lived on the communities and in the landscape for a much longer time? Mm-hmm. And the old conservation could potentially, Nature Conservancy was something that they criticized at great length for keeping people out who really had a tradition of use of that land.
Yeah. There's traditional use and traditional use. And a fair amount of the traditional use that the Conservancy was criticized for was not so traditional. Like, probably the biggest lightning rod was hunting of a wild boar and boar pig hybrids in Hawaii. I was splashed with red paint by PETA as a board member of TNC. And the native Hawaiians, you know, had for years since the introduction of boar been hunting them. The money behind the campaign was actually hunters who formed a sort of unholy alliance with both PETA and the native hunters to argue that we were somehow interfering with their traditional use, because they're terribly damaging to the conservancy, refuges, and the national park. And that's sort of been adjudicated. They're not allowed to hunt in certain areas, but they are in others. They're not allowed to, they've eradicated them from large areas of the two national parks. But they've come to some sort of modus operandi. It's certainly true that both in the U.S., more of the national park system, by the way, than the conservancy, actually removed traditional people, in the first 30 years of its existence, but have become much more sensitive to it. It's not at all clear to me that real traditional use is automatically endangering. But there are traditional uses that clearly are, and I think it's that for ethical reasons we should stop them. And a very good example is hunting Florida panthers. You know, we have about 40 of them left because largely of habitat destruction. It is a rite of passage for Seminoles to go hunt and kill them. They're not allowed to, and they complain about it. And I think it's sad, and it's not their fault that there are only 40 left, but I think it's more important to have the panthers. There's also the whale hunts, of course, that you know about in the Pacific Northwest. But I think in a very general way, you know, real traditional use probably is quite compatible with many of the activities, the old conservation. Yes?
So you waffled very well at the end. So let me just put you on the point on this one.
Do you believe that the rights of endangered wildlife supersede the rights of indigenous people to things they used to do?
Well, it's a question of the rights of existence of endangered wildlife on the one hand versus the rights of traditional peoples to do everything they have always done. And you can tell from my answer how I would answer that. We're not threatening the existence of Seminole Indians by not letting them hunt Florida panthers, right? Yes?
I'll follow with Andrew's controversial question. In asking, you know, when people are valuing a place where they're planting teak farms or eucalyptus over what is traditionally very biodiverse ecosystems, how can the scientific community help to police that sequestration of resources and opportunities for conservation when very clearly you have very strong economic interests that are taking hold of that commercialization of nature?
But you're moving into an area that I said I couldn't answer. Like, what to do about it? I think that, you know, it's obvious that we can point to the consequences of various of these, you know, extractive uses, and we've done that. What?
Should we stop valuing nature with dollars? I mean, should we stop thinking
yes.
about this as like a no dollars? We're laughing at it. You know?
I think that we should stop valuing it in dollars. I don't think there's many aspects of nature that can really be valued in dollars. Economists try to value everything in dollars, and they sort of won here because we've gotten along with it. But much of nature doesn't have a market. They tend to use contingent valuation, that is willingness to pay for the existence of some entity. But there's so many things wrong with that. An economist know it. that it's not really an accurate description of the value of nature. In addition, it's a sort of supervening thing, nature, that helps determine what the other values are. So it's not of the same order, and it can't be viewed in the same market. And what they've done here is to make nature or aspects of nature part of the same market economy as cars or what have you. And I think it's the wrong thing to do, and we shouldn't do it. Ruth?
You are sort of preaching to the choir here when you're saying that we shouldn't look at nature like, you know, with dollar values. But I think everyone in this room would agree with you that obviously the value of nature goes beyond money. But so much
conservation.
I don't
know if that's true.
I would assume so.
Many conservation biologists don't.
But so much of conservation is about getting the people with money to, you know, give that money to your cause. And I think that a lot of the things that you cited, as like evidence of the monetization of nature, was people like us, you know, biologists, trying to get people who do have the money to care about what they care about. And so they're using their language and talking in dollar signs. And you've done the same thing when you were talking about, like, trying to convince, you know, like the government to eradicate invasive species early on in the invasion and stuff like that by using the potential economic impacts later on. And you cite dollar figures of what this will cost to agriculture, you know, or different industries. So, you know, you've used the same tactic to get people who aren't biologists to care.
I haven't, but many invasion biologists have. That's true. You're right.
And it does work. Like, it gets, you know, otherwise they wouldn't be able to do anything. And by using these dollar signs, they translate it into something that, you know, industries and people who actually have the money to pay for conservation will understand and will possibly go for. And I see the dangers that you're pointing out.
I feel that it's a pittance compared to the actual cost that comes with having monetized nature. We're basically appealing for conscience money from people who have a lot of money, and we get some. And Nature Conservancy bought many of its last great places by doing exactly that. But now that we've made nature part of a market, it's working against us, because we're looking at services rather than at the biodiversity that was the original rationale for wanting to save a last great place. And so the targets are very, very
so you're
different.
Saying that in the old system, by appealing to, like, you know, the conscience of wealthy people, it wasn't working very effectively for you, but it was working for you, whereas now it's like actively working against your cause?
In the long run, I think the creation of the market, not the appealing to a particularly wealthy person to do something to save a last great place, but the fact that we've now economically valued what ecosystems do, and it is those services that we say we want to save, and the Conservancy does that, we've been hoist on our own petard, and it's now counterproductive and the wrong way to go. I feel that strongly. Yes?
So this is more of a question about the global knowledge system concept. I'm just wondering, does this old conservation idea have any room for considering maybe studying how ecosystems can evolve over time? And I think you mentioned at one point how someone had said we shouldn't be devaluing, or we shouldn't be putting down these novel ecosystems because they're new. We should be, you know, accepting them as equal to the old ecosystems and just as important.
Well, equal, I don't know. And there are all these other problems, like how will we maintain them, what services they really provide, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, ecologists have been studying what might be novel ecosystems for years and years. They provided many of the real insights that have led to the explosion of understanding of how ecosystems really work. And conservationists have not really shunned them. You know, if they're there, then ipso facto, we have to try to deal with them. But it's the fact that it provides license to just create more and more of them, and it devalues other systems that the old conservation is primarily focused on. That's what concerns me.
Okay, so it's a fear to use the term novel ecosystem. we know some people.
It sounds great to say novel. You know, it must be the new thing, and we should get behind it. And well, yes.
Do you think we will fail in our conservation? Because I went to the same conference as Andrew, and I felt like a fool in the room because I was one of the only ecologists in that area. Everybody was anthropologists and geographers. And they said that what we do here is totally unaware of what's actually happening in the place where the conservation effort is happening. On one front, you have local communities that are requiring services. On the other one, you have industry that also want to extract resources. And we as academics, we come here and we try to engage into this discourse. So I just want to know what's your opinion. Can we actually have real conservation?
Well, you know, you're treading in that area that I said I can't answer, like what to do about it. But I'm not as pessimistic that we can't do anything about it. As I said, there are certain triumphs, and there are many places that have been conserved that have endangered species in the U.S. because of the Endangered Species Act, and there are other areas around the world. And the other thing I keep thinking about, I guess many of you are too young, but to me, 1973 isn't that long ago. You know, I was already an assistant professor. 1973, the U.S. passed the Endangered Species Act. President Nixon supported it and signed it, and both houses of Congress together, only four people voted against it. And everyone was for it and thought it was the right thing to do, and there was no discussion of ecosystem services and virtually none about what it does for humans. It was because of a recognition, tacit for the most part, but sometimes explicit, that there's something wrong with letting a species go extinct when we don't have to. That it's immoral. That was in 1973. It's not that long ago. So it's what happened between 1973 and 2015 that has changed the conversation, that people don't think as much in those terms. And I don't know how to return to that, you know, to get that perspective once again in the public conversation. But, you know, people with expertise in dealing with, you know, and sociologists, psychologists, et cetera, possibly in education, possibly do. So I don't think it's impossible. Of course, it's very hard. What can I say? But I said I won't tell you how to solve it, because I don't know how. Yes?
Thank you. I was wondering, I wanted you to go back a bit on how the kind of new conservation movement is defining nature. You said something in your speech about how they're really defining nature by monetizing it. So
no, they're defining it as whatever species are there. Species are there, that's nature, period. But they've, in addition, monetized nature by characterizing nature as a set of services that nature provides and by attempting to put a monetary value on each of the services. That is the value of nature.
So are they in some ways kind of limiting nature to what only can be used by humans?
Yeah.
How much of any of this movement do you think is informed by or strengthened by the animal welfare movement? You touched on it a couple of times.
You know, my interaction with the animal welfare movement, in addition to having to get IACUC approval for the work my students and I do on vertebrates, is that they have impeded in some ways eradication of invasive species that were actually threatening the existence of biodiversity. And usually it's not been a huge factor. And the animal welfare people, often they're not a homogeneous group, and some of them can even be reasoned with. And so it's not been a huge problem. I don't see the animal welfare and animal rights movement as directly important in this evolution of this thrust and mission of conservation. You must have something in mind that I'm not.
I was recently at a conference that was entitled Compassionate Conservation, and a lot of the talk at that conference was really about instead of valuing species per se, valuing individual animals per se, and sort of bringing the ethic of animal welfare into conservation. No one in the room felt like they were doing a very good job of it, but I just wondered sort of,
Well, that's exactly where it becomes problematic in eradication of invasive species. Because on the one hand, you have the possibility of moral considerability of individual animals, especially sentient ones. Some people would say not even have to be sentient, but anything. But sentient animals on the one hand, like rats or pigs, and on the other, the existence of species or populations of them. And it's very difficult to resolve that for some of the people in the animal, more in people in the animal rights than animal welfare area. But that's the only place where I see this playing out in conservation. I'm aware of the compassionate conservation movement, but I don't think it has anything to do with this evolution that I've talked about here. Oh, you're pointing to someone. Oh, volunteer. Yeah.
So I'm curious, besides the kind of intrinsic value of nature, which I personally do not dispute, I think it's extremely important, there is this kind of obvious functional value of nature. I mean, humans, we absolutely need nature. It can be intrinsically important, but it's also functionally important. And I wonder, I see what you're saying about ecosystem services as undermining conservation for conservation's sake, but I guess I'm wondering, can ecosystem services be and? It's not just intrinsically important, it's also functionally important, and I wonder, what's the function of necessarily drawing a line in the sand and saying to think of nature as being functionally important is automatically undermining its intrinsic importance. And is there not a possible reconciliation between the idea of functional importance and intrinsic importance in kind of having a much kind of broader range of kind of rhetoric or, I guess, narratives about why nature is important?
I guess you're talking about functional importance to humans. I think it will be very difficult because automatically, when nature is characterized as these functions for humans, it leads almost inevitably to some sort of monetary valuation. If there were none whatsoever, I think it would greatly lessen the threat of the entire movement. It would still be there because it makes species interchangeable if they provide the function. And, we know for sure that we could eliminate many species and various ecosystems, it wouldn't matter to function. So it doesn't totally remove the threat. But if there were no monetary aspect and there were not the valuation of services, I think it would be much less threatening. I don't see. You're asking for some sort of grand synthesis of the two approaches, and I don't see how that would work. I think there would inevitably be tension between them, so long as we're concerned with species existence.
One last question.
I really appreciate your historical review of conservation thinking, the warring camps of conservation philosophers. And it seems to me that there's another factor that you didn't include in that review over the same time frame that strikes me as kind of the elephant in the room. And I guess I'd like your opinion on how much this might have affected thought and limited options when it comes to conservation. When, if I can make some assumptions here, when you and I were born, more or less,
in the Pleistocene,
the world was something like 4.5 billion people.
Yeah.
And now it's 7.5 billion.
No, of course.
It seems to me that's a total game changer. That's not a trivial thing. That's a call on the Earth's resources like never before, and that much of the effort in conservation is up against this incredibly difficult issue of this bulge, this surge, this massive increase in human numbers on Earth, like an eruption of mice in a grain field. And until that subsides, we've got a problem that is number one, and anything else about anything else is pretty hard. So it seems to me in that same trajectory of changes in thought and emphasis, you really have a massive change in human demography. And I'd like your thoughts on how much, if any, of that might influence the conservation thing.
I don't think that fact has led to the particular problem I'm talking about. What the huge growth of the human population has done is exacerbated the difficulty of any kind of conservation, but in particular, the original conservation of species, because they have to be in habitat that then has to be restricted in some way. And when there are twice as many people, it's going to be, and it is already, vastly more difficult. I don't see that fact of the growth of human population has led to the focus on ecosystem services. That was viewed as a strategy to engage more of the public. I was involved in discussions at the time by the people that did this, and I didn't agree, but they all felt that this would get more people behind us because it would save species in the long run. And that's what hasn't worked. And I don't think that the fact that there are twice as many people now, or even more than that, there will be. There are now, 7 point something billion is what led to the focus on ecosystem services on the one hand and its monetization, which was an inevitable consequence. It just exacerbated how hard it is to do real conservation of biodiversity. I also don't see how a focus on ecosystem services is really responding to the problems generated by the overpopulation of the Earth, but that's another matter entirely.
The connection I wondered about is more the notion of novel ecosystems, which is new to me, but certainly the fact of highly altered ecosystems in the world means that the turf available for conservation is pretty restricted unless you expand your notion of something that's considerable to something that's fairly disturbed relative to what we might have considered as a human-free functioning ecosystem.
Well, there's still a huge amount that's worth preserving that could be preserved if we wanted to, and it just makes it vastly harder that there are more and more and more people that want it for other purposes.
Thank you very much for your attention, and please come and thank you.
Thank you.